what we've seen is that the beer companies, and by that I mean something like a De Grey or even Genesis, we've sold both of those this year because we thought that they held their valuations pretty well. But the junior explorers have been smashed. So you put that into your sort of thinking cap and you think, well, is that really a recessionary fact? Can that be happening while China's going backwards? Perhaps China is not going as badly as some of the other indicators would have us believe.
More generally, what do you think of companies coming out with exploration targets?
Because to put out an inferred resource, you're now having to put out something that's got a reasonable prospect of economic extraction at current commodity price. So that's almost talking like a reserve. So I think what's happened is that the exploration target has almost taken the place of the inferred resource.
Money Miners, Tuesday, 22nd of August.
Hey, you got a high pitch in the voice today.
Money Miners. Jeez, rapid excitement's every day.
I think it's a proximity between like the last vape suck and you doing the intro. Like there's sometimes never, it can be a bit too high.
It's always a bloody small short proximity to it.
Oh.
Well, we are revealing today some more of JD's on the road interviews when he was in Melbourne. But good trip overall, JD.
It was, mate.
Is it worth being away from me that long?
Oh, nothing's worth being away from you, mate.
Crying yourself to sleep every night, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's tough without you. But it was a super interesting chat. So this one is with John Ford, who's the Chief Investment Officer at Lowell Resources Fund. You guys had a chat with Richie Morrow.
Richie Morrow, absolute GC. He watched the State of Origin with me in Melbourne and got a bit of an insight into my character. I don't know, he doesn't call
me.
I know he still did.
Steep learning curve.
He did call me after that, so it's all good. I didn't burn the relationship. How'd it go, JD? What'd you get into?
I think it went pretty well. So
more talk in the book or more talk in strategy or a bit of everything?
A bit of everything. We talk a lot about macro and a big focus actually on how they like to invest, going quite deep on their style. So they've got quite a big book. They've got almost 80 stocks that they hold and they're really focused on that very early stage. They don't hold any development businesses. They're all in that, you know, grassroots, in that resource definition phase. So focusing on those big multi-bag winners and hopefully those, you know, winners that they do have outweigh the ones that don't end up going anywhere. So
like
it's a kind of
a venture.
Exactly. Like a venture capital style investor.
Fascinating.
I'll be interested to hear what their take is on, how that macro view links to their investment strategy.
Yeah, so a bit on the macro. And then we dove into commodities and what they're sort of thinking around certain commodities and then talking about the various stocks that they do hold. And then a quick underrated, overrated section.
Mate, compliments to Manny Datt, the first person that's ever been interviewed that's correctly done an overrated, underrated and just said it.
People are getting better. They're getting better.
Without a long-winded.
I reckon Kingsley was number one on that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Manny Datt did the proper quick fire. He did it spot on.
Yeah,
Kingsley was great as well.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
I reckon we'll rip straight into it, but before we do.
Oh, the good old partners of the show. Anytime Exploration, the foundation sponsor for Money of Mine, Seamus Murphy. Hit up anytime. Anytime and anything exploration.
Anywhere. Maybe not anywhere. Probably only WA.
Anywhere.
Are they further than WA?
I think just WA.
Just WA. But all your exploration stuff, go to Seamus.
I like that. You said that well, Trav. And our bromances, my bromances at Terra Capital, Matty Langsford and Jeremy Bond.
That's it. Natural Resource Fund, Terra Capital.
And
thanks,
possibly
guys.
Coming on the show next week.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Old DK Dylan Kelly's going to come on.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah, he's the smart one, I think.
Oh, jeez, Trav. Wait till they're paid their invoice before you start throwing them ones out, mate. I will give a prelude because it's pretty exciting. Bit of a rare earths spectacular. DK is an absolute guru. And we're going to talk clays and carbonatite. So looking forward to that next week. Righto, here we go.
Righto, Money Miners. We've got a special guest here today, John Forward, CIO, Chief Investment Officer of Lowell Resource Fund. John, how are you?
Jonas, I'm very well and great to be here with you.
Beautiful. Why don't we start by you giving a quick rundown on a bit in your personal history and then what Lowell Resources Fund is all about?
Yeah, look, my background is as a geologist. I spent about 5 years as an exploration geologist before rolling over into the dark side, and I've spent the last 25 years on the finance side of mining. Most of that with a crowd called RMB, Rand Merchant Bank out of South Africa, focusing on Aussies going into Africa. So we finance, people might remember, Anvil Mining or Aquarius Platinum, ASX listed companies with projects in Africa. But then we actually branched out, and having offices here in Australia, my claim to fame is financing both Northern Star and Saracen into their first gold mines. So
pretty decent claim to fame.
Yeah, look, got to at least have one box to tick there. So, while it was RMB, we had largely in-house fund called the Telluride Fund, which invested in junior resources globally. And then in 2016, I moved and I joined Lower Resources Fund, which did a very similar thing. So Lower Resources Fund, I'm sure we'll discuss it, but it invests globally solely in junior resources stocks.
Beautiful. And in digging up a bit into your past, I noticed you worked in Indonesia for a while, and I couldn't help but notice this coincided with the infamous BRIEX scandal time period. What was it like working in Indonesia at the time? And did you have any sort of experience brushing shoulders with any of those characters?
Look, it's a big country. I was in a very different part of Indonesia, but certainly everything was going south by the time I finished up there in 1998. The Suharto era was coming to an end. East Timor was moving towards independence, and it was blowing up. We had an office on West Timor, so it got quite hairy at some points. But my favourite anecdote about the BRIEX scandal was used to be something called the Jakarta Mining Club, and they sent out a notice, for their annual or their monthly meeting, and the one straight after the BRIEX scandal said all the nuts will be unsalted.
I love it. We've got a episode in the future to dig into the whole scandal. I find it fascinating. Trav and I have both read a couple books. I want to get into how you guys at Lowell and yourself like to invest now. And I noticed digging into the latest monthly report that you're not holding any companies in the development phase. Is that a sort of anomaly, or is that a consistent sort of policy that you guys have at Lowell?
Yeah, look, it's not an anomaly. It's definitely a policy. What we try and do is follow, I'm sure people are familiar with the Lassonde curve, which, the classic curve, you see a massive uplift in share price as you go from exploration through discovery to definition of resource and reserve. Then you have a big drop off. It can be big or small in terms of this orphan period of, the boring stuff, financing, permitting, engineering and actually building the project. And then hopefully you have a pickup as you go into cash flow. So we try and match our whole allocations a bit to that. So we're a reasonable amount, say 20% in the grassroots exploration phase, which by that I mean no resources. And then the largest portion of our portfolio is in the resources plus exploration, which means that there's a resource defined, but we think that there's a multiple there to grow that resource at hopefully a similar or better grade. And then, we try and drop off in terms of feasibility. That's typically when we would look to sell. Now, sometimes we don't. We hang on, and we hang on through the development phase because we really like the upside. Like Gold Road was an example where they went into the development phase, but we hung on because they got a good partner in who knew what they were doing. And there still is some fantastic exploration potential.
John, there's plenty of threads for me to pick up on there. I want to start with selling and how you guys know it's the right time to sell. So the Lassonde curve is something we're quite familiar with. We designed the logo on it at Money of Mine. And like you said, you're targeting that top of the first peak. How do you sort of know it's the right time to let go of some shares?
Look, you never get the absolute top. So what we try and do is average our exit. And typically, we've recently finished our exit from De Grey Mining. That traded in a band from, say, 90 cents to $1.54 for quite some time. And we tried to sell, obviously, towards the upper end of that band. But, you know, what we do is not sell in all in one block. That's probably, it's not a secret, but that way you can average it over time and you'll never get the top, but hopefully you won't get the worst price either.
And are there other tells, like when the company starts talking a lot more about getting into studies and those sorts of things, when it's not so much, you know, how many drill rigs can you get on the site, that sort of lead you to know when it's time to go?
Yeah, look, that's definitely one of them. I think, you know, and I just, you know, watch their feet, not their mouths. You know, look at how much money is going to be going towards exploration versus development. So, you know, the classic example is, you know, in that orphan period where the banks get their fingers into you, and you're not allowed to do any. Basically, there's no free cash flow for exploration for a number of years. So that, you know, is going to take, unless they absolutely shoot the lights out in terms of commissioning and the price. If a company has good exposure to the spot price, then, you know, you will see more share price appreciation. But more often than not, you know, that doesn't unfortunately happen in the commissioning phase.
Yeah, too right. Another thing you touched on earlier that I want to dive into is allocating between companies in the different stages. And you said a number, 20%. I think the latest was that you had 30% in that grassroots phase. Firstly, how do you go about identifying, you know, not lifestyle businesses, companies that are serious exploration businesses that have a chance of finding something that's going to be meaningful?
Look, we can sit here and put up our shingle and say we've got money for junior resources, and particularly at the moment, you get absolutely flooded with opportunities. But identifying the right ones, look, there are some fantastic companies out there that come through the door that for whatever reason we're not able to invest in, whether we've got our existing allocation to that particular commodity or, you know, one of the shareholders is someone we, you know, don't get on with or whatever. So, look, it is hard to say no to a lot of these companies, but I've got a chairman of my investment committee who's always banging the drum about no more stocks, we don't want any more stocks in the portfolio. So I've got to be really ruthless and often, you know, if I want to put one in, I've got to, you know, sell one.
And at a portfolio level, is there a sort of sweet spot in terms of how many, you know, what proportion comes from grassroots, what proportion comes from companies in that resource definition sort of stage and beyond? Do you have a target in terms of that, or is it more bottom-up companies you like?
Yeah, look, I think we do like to have a diversification, if you like, across the risk spectrum. So, you know, grassroots, obviously a much higher risk. And, you know, companies sitting on a reserve, lower risk.
And does different commodities play into that as well? You know, not all in gold, for example.
Absolutely. So, you know, our gold exposure has varied quite a bit over the last 12 months, you know, or 2 years. It's got as high as 60%, and currently it's down around 30%, partly because, or mainly because, gold explorers are so unloved at the moment. But we do like to at least try and target and aim for a diversification of commodity allocation between precious metals, base, battery, and we also do a bit of oil and gas, which we probably won't talk too much about today.
I've actually got a question on that coming up, but in that portfolio construction, I noticed that you guys are at, I think, 2.5% in cash. Is that just a reflection of where we are and how cheap you things are out there at the moment?
Yeah, look, absolutely. What we've done this year is what we've seen is that the bigger companies, and by that I mean something like a De Grey or even something like Genesis, we've sold both of those this year because we thought that they held their valuations pretty well. But the junior explorers have been smashed. And so what we've done is recycle some of that money from the sales of these larger market caps into things that have really been hit hard, and generally things that are already in our portfolio.
One last one on the portfolio construction. So I could see that you held 82 stocks last time I checked, and it sort of reminds me of a bit of a venture capital type approach where you have, you know, multi-bag winners like De Grey, Gold Road and those sorts of stocks that outweigh the losses. How do you sort of think about that? How many big winners do you really need to outweigh the ones that don't end up going
you know, too far up the curve.
Look, we'd like to have one big winner a year. And yeah, look, it is a lot of stocks in the portfolio, but Predictive Discovery is one of our top holdings still. And that was a labour of love over more than 10 years. So we invested in the IPO in that, I think it was 2012, in fact, before my time. And we pretty much invested in every, at least once a year in every placement they did over the ensuing period before they made their big discovery. And if we hadn't invested in that last placement that they did just before the big discovery, which was done at half a cent, now it's trading at 18 odd cents today, we would have been underwater in that stock. So, you know, while, you know, people said, oh, Predictive, it's a penny dreadful, look, you know, and it was in the bottom drawer in our portfolio, we continue to like the management and their exploration portfolio. So we didn't put big dollars in over a lot of that time, but we continue to participate, and that can be the key to having some faith.
I want to put a pin in Predictive now and touch on it more when we get into stock specific type of chat. But for now, I want to look at the macro level, and I want to hear from you how much sort of analysis goes into the macro side of things. Given you're a micro cap fund. Taking China, for example, they have a huge, you know, outweighed impact on the world of commodities. And unlike the rest of the world, we've seen them go into deflation in the last month while we're all here talking about inflation. How much time do you spend looking at the macro to start with? And are you predicting any sort of stimulus from China?
Look, yeah, you know, China's the elephant in the room in many cases. You know, I always say that it's the US and their economy which has the most effect on share prices, but it's China and their economy that has the most effect on commodity prices. So, yeah, we do look at China pretty carefully. There's some really interesting data that's come out just recently showing that, you know, China, as you mentioned, China's in deflation, and its recovery since COVID has been absolutely anemic, which is bad for commodities. And we've seen a lot of commodity prices be soft, if not, you know, falling. But the oil market is really interesting at the moment. We've just last month, the global oil consumption hit all-time record of 103 million barrels a day. And 70% of the growth has come from China. So you put that into your sort of thinking cap and you think, well, is that really a recessionary fact? Can that be happening while China's going backwards? You know, China's, you know, a real conundrum, but we see that as a bright spot and bright marker in saying that perhaps China is not going as badly as some of the other indicators would have us believe.
So on the flip side of that, you've got Australia, and we have had high inflation leading to higher interest rates, and that's what is also the other thing that's directly impacting the markets we look at, the micro and the small cap miners. With the cost of capital going up, you know, liquidity has come out and a lot of the prices for these juniors has come off. Are you encouraging the companies that you speak with to, you know, tighten the belt, cut back on spending, or would you rather see them still go at it with their drilling programs? How do you sort of have that discussion with the companies?
Oh, look, you know, we back management to run their companies as they see best. But look, you know, in the current environment, if you, typical junior explorer, put out a, you know, a nice good grade gold intersection, in many cases, that's just a liquidity event for investors, and you know, you might see a blip one day and then it'll be sold off the next. So in that environment, you know, is there really a point in going hard with your drilling programs? Unless, of course, you know, drilling becomes very cheap, which is possible. Like, you know, just over at Diggers and Dealers, there was a lot of talk about rigs being parked up, a lot of rig availability. But I haven't actually heard of drilling rates becoming substantially cheaper. If that happened, then I think, you know, companies should be taking advantage of going out there and drilling their best prospects. But right at the moment, in gold in particular, I would question the value of being aggressive and pumping out drill results, which are going to be ignored.
And one of the other sort of liquidity events would be a takeout, an M&A. And we've seen it with one of the stocks you guys hold, Musgrave, recently. Are you sort of anticipating more M&A in the mining space in the near future, or do you think that's on hold for the minute?
Yeah, look, M&A's been very much a slow burn. There's been very little urgency in from the acquirers to you know, do the M&A. Even though in the gold space in particular, there's a lot of companies sitting on growing cash piles. So yeah, you know, some of these producers, you know, 100,000 ounce producer who's going well at the moment, you know, sort of the benchmark is like $1 billion market cap. Thinking of, you know, Emerald Resources, for example, and that they might be they are an acquirer in WA at the moment. But you know, Musgrave's an example. The PFS got completed on their Q Gold project. That triggered Westgold to make an all-scrip bid. We thought it was fairly modestly priced. And then it almost was reluctantly that Ramelius came out and said, oh, okay, we'll give you a 10% premium on that, even though the economics are pretty compelling in terms of synergies and tracking the Musgrave's Q project or to their, you know, Mount Magnet or Q operations. So, look, it's a bit like pulling teeth. I think there has been quite a bit of M&A activity, and I'm sure there'll be more. We've invested in a few that we think might be, you know, are in the heart of the, you know, possible areas of consolidation. Astral's one, Saturn is another, a little tiddler called Carnival is another. That'll happen, but you've got to be patient at the moment.
Before we dive into those stock specifics, I've got a few questions on commodities as a whole. So first I want to talk about copper. And it seems like every resource fund manager we speak with is bullish copper, but it's been this way for a year or 2 years now, and the copper price hasn't really gone anywhere. So to start with, are you sort of one of those in that camp as well, bullish on copper?
Look, I have to say we are, but I'm cautiously bullish. You know, I think back to nickel, two and a half years ago, everyone was saying, oh, we're going to be massively short of nickel. It's, you know, where's it going to come from? And you know, the supply-demand gap is going to be enormous. Then all of a sudden, Indonesia comes out with, you know, seems to have cracked the code for their lateritic nickels, and they're going to be pushing out, you know, 30% of the nickel market, possibly more within a few years. And that gap in nickel, and I know there's class one and class two nickel, but that gap overall in nickel seems to have disappeared. So we do need to be cautious about and making forecasts on supply and demand. But copper is a much bigger market than nickel. It's probably 10 times the size. And so when you see a 8 million tonne per annum supply demand gap opening up by, you know, in the early 2030s, that is massive. And trying to fill that hole is, you know, almost a gargantuan task. So you have to be bullish on copper. Why it hasn't taken off sooner, look, that's a real head scratcher, because, you know, visible stockpiles are really low. You know, they're at decade lows in warehouses. So there must be invisible stockpiles somewhere, and maybe Chinese consumers are sitting on big stocks, and that's quite possible. But also, there's some interesting data out there that says, well, what actually drives the copper price is not the level of stockpiles; it's the demand, consumption. So, and that makes sense. So, until we see consumption really start to take off, I think the copper price might go sideways.
And on your comments on nickel there, does that mean you're pulling out or not putting any more money into nickel hopefuls around the world?
Look, it's not in our top few commodities to target. But look, nickel is. Is super volatile, and right now it looks a bit looks weak, but you know, it's probably one of the most volatile commodities historically, and things can happen very quickly in the nickel market, which it's sort of broken at the moment. You know, that issue with Mr. Big in the nickel in the nickel market. When was that? Was that earlier this year on the LME? The nickel market does look broken in terms of a functioning market. So we're pretty cautious, but for the right opportunity, yeah, we'll definitely look at nickel.
Lithium's another one I want to talk about. My first question here is, did you feel at Diggers it was a bit overhyped? There's clearly a few names, Azure one of them, which we'll get into later, as the talk of the town. Does it feel a bit overhyped at the moment to you?
Look, it's definitely hyped and it's very, very hot. But when you've got, you know, the big guys or the producers making truckloads of cash, and you've also got the off-takers, you know, be it Stellantis and car makers or, you know, lithium chemical companies throwing money right up at, well, right down at the bottom end of the supply chain and, you know, exploration almost, there's a justification for the hype. Where lithium goes from here is really anybody's guess, and we're certainly seeing a soft period here in the middle of the year in terms of lithium carbonate prices. But the spodumene concentrate price has held up pretty well, and that's really what matters to WA lithium players. There's just a massive margin there.
Did you make much of the new Chinese futures exchange in the lithium market that came out? I think it traded down 15-odd% on the first day. Is that something you paid much attention to?
Yeah, sure. That's definitely a really interesting marker, and maybe the lithium market is following the iron ore market, which had a number of years ago developed exchange trading. So that's obviously a negative marker. I think it finished limit down on opening day, and it's continued to trend down. There's obviously a disconnect between the concentrate market and the chemical market. Once it goes into China, it becomes quite opaque. But the spodumene market is still strong.
And the last commodity or broad basket of commodities I want to touch on is oil and gas and coal, energy broadly. How does this sort of play a role in your portfolio? I think it was 8% last time I looked. How do you guys sort of think about that versus the hard rock mining assets that you hold?
Yeah, look, the oil and gas, you know, something we've always done, and it's been around that 8% level or 8-10% level for a long time, in our portfolio. It's absolutely unloved. In fact, it's actively hated by many investors, institutional and retail. But you can and we take the same approach to oil and gas as we do to hard rock minerals. In that, you know, we're really looking for a significant exploration upside. So if there is a significant oil or gas discovery by a junior who has, you know, good exposure to it, you can still see multiples on your money. We've seen that in the Perth Basin. We saw that with an investment we made in a company called Melbana in Cuba. And we'll continue to see that. You know, as I mentioned before, the demand for oil is not going away. It's in fact growing. So there's a large proportion of the investor base that won't invest in oil and gas, and that money is probably part of the money that's created the lithium hype. There's still substantial attention on that market. And look, the oil market. If you're in resources and commodities, the oil market is, I think it's $2 trillion a year, which is almost 10 times the next biggest market, which is iron ore. So it is hard to ignore.
Absolutely. I want to get into stock specific now, and I'm sure this is what people really want to hear. So I want to start with Azure. So they're capped at, I think, $850 million last time I looked, and that's, you know, given that they hold 60% rather of the Andover project. And we saw just a couple of days ago that there was a rumoured or a proposed takeover at, I think, roughly $2.30. What did you make of the takeover? And are you sort of encouraging management there to push away any bids at the moment?
Look, I would have thought, you know, and that $2.30 number came out yesterday, I think it was, and the share price had already run. I think it got up to into $2.90 intraday. And then it's fallen back, and I think currently it's around $2.60 as we're speaking.
Yeah, I think so.
It's a little bit academic. It does, I think, for a time at least, put a floor under the price. So that gives investors comfort. I'm sure that what happened was SQM went to the company and probably they went to Mark Creasy first because he got 40% of the project and, you know, 14% of the company. Said, "Are you interested?" And Mark probably said no. And that was probably the end of the conversation. So I would think, you know, I'm very pleased that we're in the same tent as Mark Creasy. He always extracts full value. I think $2.30 is a lowball bid for what is shaping up as a world-class, if not one of the best deposits in hard rock lithium in the world.
And what did you make of the exploration target that they came out with? And more generally, what do you think of companies coming out with exploration targets?
Look, I think there's been interesting development in JORC resources and exploration targets. And one thing I got out of Diggers this year was the exploration target is almost the new inferred resource, because to put out an inferred resource, you're now having to put out something that's got a RPEE, reasonable prospect of economic extraction, which, as I understand it from what I've heard of what the ASX demands, is you've got to show that your inferred resource is has potentially positive economics at current commodity price. So that's almost talking like a reserve. So I think what's happened is that the exploration target has almost taken the place of the inferred resource. Not quite, obviously, because you put a tonnage and a grade range on an exploration target. But, yeah, look, very positive. You know, 6 months ago, as you were saying, well, you know, we're targeting 100 million tonnes at north of 1%. Now 100 million tonnes at north of 1% is the very bottom end of the range. And the top end they're talking about is 240 at up to 1.5. So, that could be just a starter.
And it makes up a pretty significant part of the portfolio now. When is it sort of, like we touched on at the beginning of the conversation, going to be time to start letting go of a few there? Is there a cutoff within the fund when one stock becomes too big a number?
Look, we don't have mandated cutoffs in our investment mandate. We do when we first go into a stock, but if it grows organically, we're not forced to sell. So we can hang on to that for as long as we see fit. And I think there's a lot more upside in that deposit. They've got five or six rigs drilling at the moment. They're going pretty methodically. They're doing heritage clearance. Hopefully 240 million tonnes ends up being a conservative upside.
Another lithium player I want to talk about is Delta Lithium. And I couldn't surmise whether you guys still hold a few, but we have, David Flanagan on the show not too long ago, and he's a pretty lively guy. What was it that attracted you guys when you did previously hold the stock and may do to the company?
Look, just taking a step back, lithium has been very kind to the fund over a number of years. You know, firstly, we were in Kidman, and we got into that originally for its Mount Holland Gold project. Then we were in Liontown. We did get into that specifically for lithium.
Azure for nickel?
We originally got into Azure for nickel, I have to confess. And Red Dirt, we got in there when they bought the Mount Ida Gold project, right? Which quickly became a lithium project.
And a bad pickup for 10 odd million, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So, better to be lucky than smart, as they say. And when we saw that, you know, the share price, I think, ran to a dollar pretty quickly and pulled back. And, it's been up and down since then. But when they got into Yinnetharra, I thought, oh, well, that looks like a really good project as well. So we held on. But we have actually exited Delta recently, just because it probably doesn't have the same upside that we see at Azure. So, and we're trying to manage our lithium exposure somewhat.
They just one more on Delta. They did have a huge block of stock that crossed. I'm not sure if you saw. I think 11% of the company a couple of days ago. And given the sort of nature of it, it seems to have a strategic buyer's name on it. It was done at a 23% premium. Do you think the ultimate outcome for a stock like Delta is a takeover, or do you see these sorts of players, you know, going and becoming producers in the near term, given that we see Gina, MinRes and all those sorts of names on the register?
Yeah, look, I think you know, that Gascoyne region is becoming a bit of a hot bit of real estate. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is a takeout there at some point. But, you know, Dave Flanagan, he's, you know, taken companies through into development and production in the past. So I'm sure that's a capacity that the company has. And if they don't get the right bid, I'm sure they'll go right through.
Okay, I want to get into another success story that you guys have had, what we touched on earlier, Predictive Discovery. So they came out, I think, during Diggers, beginning of last week, and upgraded the resource to almost 5.4 million ounces from memory. What I sort of want to know how you think with Predictive is there any alternative for a company like this, kind of like what I just touched on with Delta, to end in any other sort of outcome other than a takeover?
Look, I think, you know, everyone's predicting that a takeover will happen. And, you know, it was interesting to see a number of Canadians floating around Diggers. You know, B2 Gold were there. They're active in West Africa. We've seen recent M&A activity in West Africa, you know, with Chesser in a small way. So, look, I think that's, you know, it's a world-class discovery. There's not too many projects like Northeast Bankan that, you know, grow rapidly from nothing to, you know, over 5 million ounces in a very short space of time at a good grade. So, look, I think there's a couple of catalysts there. And as we saw with Musgrave, I don't think it was coincidence that the PFS came out and then there was a takeover bid. I think we need to see some catalysts at Predictive. The obvious one is sorting out the buffer zone of the national park, and that on the company's timetable will hopefully occur first half of next year. They've also got some interesting exploration results to come out in the next couple of weeks on satellite projects up at Argo. So that's trigger. And then I think, you know, if we can see the gold price, you know, move say 10% higher, that will help re-rate that company significantly. So yeah, look, I think you know, if we sit here in 12 months' time, there could well be some corporate activity that's come out of the woodwork.
And just on West Africa more broadly, it's clearly a risk you guys are comfortable with. Do you think other investors are missing out on potential alpha not going to West Africa? How do you sort of get comfortable? Obviously, it's sort of country by country there. But what's your sort of process in analysing different countries within West Africa?
Yeah, look, I mean, my background, I've spent quite a bit of time in West Africa, not all the countries, but there's certainly places which are, you know, preferable and places which are no-go zones. You know, Niger has become very hard. At least half of Burkina Faso has become very hard. And hats off to Richard Hyde at WEF for his magnificent effort at Sembrado. But, places like Côte d'Ivoire, you know, still quite attractive. Guinea also I think is quite attractive and a very strong mining industry in that country. So, yeah, you know, we're certainly horses for courses. I think in West Africa there's that African discount has become even stronger, and it's because while Aussie companies are still funded to some extent to invest there, The money out of North America, which is the other, you know, other market which provides funding for West Africa, has completely dried up in terms of exploration. You're seeing the multiples on per ounce basis. Even in Australia they've dropped, but they've dropped even further in West Africa because the competition from the Canadians is just not there.
Moving to WA Gold now, whilst we had your colleague Richard Morrow on the show 3-odd months ago, the Gwalia takeover is in the works. It sort of was playing out and Musgrave had yet to be pounced upon. That's since happened, and Musgrave was obviously a holding of yours. Were you guys happy with how that played out there?
Look, we always want more. And, you know, we're still waiting for, you know, the final bid to play out. You know, there may be some further bidder that, you know, there's a very small chance that something else would come out of the woodwork. As I say, I think it's not a hot gold market at the moment. And, you know, in a hot gold market, you could have seen a substantially greater premium.
Pat Gold is another one. We're going to Queensland now. A much smaller player, but I hadn't heard of it, and I was reading up prior to our discussion today on it. And just looking at the register there, there's yourselves, RCF, and a few other institutions on the register. They've had some pretty pretty great gold hits, and it's in relatively in a region where there are some gold mines about. What sort of excites you about Pat Gold?
Look, I think it's the grade and the scale. So they've obviously got some really nice high grades in their central F1A zone. They've recently discovered a parallel zone to that, 1 meter at 40 grams with just one drill hole into that. But it's really the strike extent. That is, you know, 30 kilometres indicated by rock chips, historic drilling, and they seem to have cracked the code with geophysics in using IP and highlighting that that zone for 30 Ks. You know, they've done the cheaper gradient array surface IP, and they've started to roll out the dipole IP to define that zone. So, you know, that 30 Ks, there could be numerous deposits along that 30 Ks, and they will be more than likely plunging chutes, but there could be parallel zones in those plunging chutes. So, yeah, it's the scale of the project which is attracting people like us, but I know there's been interest from gold majors as well and looking at it.
And another smaller gold player that you guys are in is Saturn, you touched on earlier as well. So they've got a bit over 100 million tonnes at a bit over half a gram per tonne. And on the surface, that seems like quite hard work, and the market's not ascribing an awful lot of value to it at the moment. What's the sort of catalyst for things to change, or what do you think's different that the market's not quite seeing there?
Yeah, look, I think it's perhaps a difference between the Aussie market and the North American market. There's a number of projects like that making good money in North America, which I've visited in the past, and economies of scale. So while there is pressure on operating costs, that looks like it'll be a low strip ratio bulk mining operation with some excellent heap leach metallurgy. So you put all that together, heap leach generally means lower capex and lower opex, and the recoveries look to be in the high 70%. So yeah, look, put all that together, and I think the scoping study NPV at current Aussie dollar gold prices is pushing $1 billion, and the market cap is somewhere around 20 million. There's just a really big disconnect there, which I think in a better gold market, you know, you could see that re-rate, you know, easily re-rate five times.
And a company in a similar boat is Medallion. I've got to disclose that I own a couple of these, so I'm a bit conflicted here, but they're similar in the sense they've got over 1 million ounces. They're capped at 15 odd million. I take it from reading in that Lowell's come in somewhat recently into the stock. What is the catalyst here for a change? Is it just a change in the overall gold environment that needs to turn, or is there things more at a stock specific level that can, you know, make the market look at this one a bit differently?
Yeah, look, I think they're still very much, you know, they have done a lot of the feasibility work at Medallion, but they're still very much in the exploration stage, and there's a lot of low hanging fruit exploration targets that they've got to go and test. So I think there'll be value added, you know, to the resource will grow, and it could grow quite quickly and cheaply. But also, I think the gold market, you know, we just saw that and thought, wow, that looks super cheap. It was too cheap to ignore. We've been following it for a long time. Paul Bennett's a good friend of mine, and he's a very good operator. And so we just thought, well, you know, it may get cheaper, but it's a very good time to enter.
And the last individual stock I want to get your take on is Comet Ridge. And I've got to say, I'm not super familiar. This is a gas play in the East Coast, but gas and energy more broadly in the East Coast is something that's been in the media quite a lot over the past 18 or so months. Does that make up a lot of the play, or is there more going on with the team specifically at Comet Ridge that warms you to the stock?
Look, East Coast gas, yeah, it's been a political football that's been kicked around terribly. Fortunately, the junior producers and the domestic producers, which is what Comet Ridge will be, are exempt from the code of conduct, the gas code of conduct. So basically that means that they can get market price. And market price is, you know, currently north of $12 a gigajoule, which is fantastic. WA's prices, as you know, the Perth Basin gas price has zoomed up from a couple of bucks a gigajoule to, I think it recently was around $9 a gigajoule, but you're getting more over here. It's interesting that the value that is being attributed to gas companies on the East Coast is probably less than what you're getting in the Perth Basin, even though the prices, you know, for these guys on the East Coast is probably going to be higher.
So why is that from my inexperienced eye?
It's just supply demand. Here in Victoria, basically there's been a moratorium on gas drilling for a number of years, and Bass Strait production is falling off a cliff. So whereas in WA there's probably slightly less pressure on the supply demand balance.
Understood. Okay, I want to get into a quick fire round to wrap things up on underrated and overrated. So one word answers. I'm just going to read out. Could be a stock, an issue, a commodity, or whatever, and we'll see how we go. So to start with, AW1. This is American West Metals. They've had some copper hits up in Canada.
Look, I've not followed closely, but I've certainly heard a lot of people mention it. We've had a presentation in the past. I know it went for a Zoom and has come back. It may still be slightly overrated.
West African jurisdictional risk.
I think that's over-emphasised.
WA1 with the Lunny discovery up in the West Arunta.
What a great and sort of... Region defining discovery. I think it's fantastic. I think from an exploration point of view, it's probably underrated. But from a market niobium point of view, perhaps I think it's blue sky. People don't know anything about niobium, so they think there's plenty of blue sky to it.
Gwalia.
Look, hopefully underrated. I know, you know, Rally will wave his magic wand, and I think he'll be able to get some economies out of that.
The future of uranium.
Overrated.
Oh, interesting. The Abra mine, Galena's silver, lead.
Underrated.
Liontown Resources.
So we've sold out, so I probably have to say it's overrated.
Last one, Dreadnought Resources, the rare earth play.
Yeah, look, I can't call that one. I think it's very, very interesting, and I know they're about to get out there and drill their copper discovery. So they've got fingers in a number of pies, potentially underrated.
Perfect. Well, thanks heaps for your time, John. Thanks for making it available. I'm sure the money miners will get plenty of value. So, yeah, once more, thank you.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Beautiful.
Oh, sensational work, JD. And cheers, Johnny, for coming on Money of Mine. Absolute love the chat.
Yeah, hope the Money Miner's got a bit of value from that one.
Oh, how would you not talking to a bloody fundie about all their tips and tricks?
That's it. Always something you can pick up.
And the fact that you're on it as well, JD, maximising the value.
Stop, you make me blush, mate.
Right, thanks to always our partners, Terra Capital, K-Drill.
Anytime Exploration Services.
JP Search.
Top Drill.
JP Search, let us know if you got Alex a job, old Ali G from last week's episode.
Hoodaroo.
You won't get away with it. We will know.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.